Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Decorating Pages podcast presents Production Design Film Study. This class examines Oscar-nominated films spanning a century of cinema. Accomplished professionals in production design will explore and dissect the sets featured in these nominated films and will educate why they were recognized for the design of their time. This class features the films of 1965. And this year's films will be reviewed by Kim Wanup, set decorator, and Adam Rao, production designer.
Well, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Because this is what I thought about a lot. Like, what were your feelings about what we do now?
Right.
Watching movies that were the best of 1965. Did you have any, like, thoughts about comparing what we do now to then?
Well, what I thought is it can't really compare, but I also thought with watching black and white films, how different it is. You know, rarely do you get a black. I mean, Mank was, you know, probably the last one and won for, you know, an Oscar, but it's decorating and designing for black and white now, I would think might be harder than then. Because with the cameras and, like, the tones and the lighting and, like, all that shit, where it, not that it seemed easier back then, but they had that dialed in to me.
Was the movie that came out about Lucille Ball recently, with that, with Nicole Kidman, was that in black and white? I don't remember.
I think that was color.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say you can't compare. I heavily compared. Like, most of my experience of watching it was comparing, and I mean, I found that, first of all, 1965 was a tough year. I mean, if you walked away with the Oscar,
yeah,
Dr. Zhivago did, like, you had some hearty competition.
Yeah.
And you know, Dr. Zhivago, I think, did deserve it. But I was thinking about how we make stuff, and it was like, it's the rare Games of Thrones is kind of what I use as the high bar for television. And for movies, I didn't see Oppenheimer, but I'm going to assume it was.
It's fantastic.
Like, the scale of these projects, I mean, not all of them. Dr. Zhivago, for sure, The Sound of Music. I didn't watch The Greatest Story Ever Told, but I'm assuming, like, not just scenically. I mean, of course, scenery is a big part of it, but the amount of extras that they used was just mind-boggling. I mean, absolutely mind-boggling.
Yes.
I couldn't believe some of the scenes. And then also, you know, watching other older movies that are not just from that decade, like, we can't do that, or we computer generate it and we get the idea.
Well, I think that's what I mean, though, as we can't compare, because we do things so much differently now. So I was watching these films and thinking, like, they don't have CGI, these are all real people, like, wow. Like,
yeah,
that, like that.
Okay, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
So we're feeling the same thing. We're just thinking about a different way.
Yeah.
The other thing that I thought about is that, you know, having just seen the Barbie movie, and we could talk about that too, but like, the face of the actor is so dominant in projects right now, on any, even video games. Like, it's the face or the experience of us being close to that person. Whereas I found, at least in the movies in 1965, especially Dr. Zhivago and Sound of Music, you got to experience a wide shot for long periods of time.
Yeah.
You got to love the mountains in the back in Austria, and you got to enjoy battlescapes and they used wides in a way that I was really envious of. I was like, man, they're showing the world and they're not afraid of it. And that had to be harder back then.
Yeah.
Like, you'd have to.
But I think that is, so you had, I mean, we both watched Zhivago and you had Sound of Music. Greatest Story Ever Told, there were wides. But once I read that it was like Arizona and California, it was like, oh. But like for me, Patch of Blue, which is basically MacArthur Park and then some apartments and a couple of like LA streets. Yes, they had some wides to show it, but really it was so confined. And Ship of Fools was very, I mean, they were on that ship. And it was
What's funny about, okay, so I think we probably should tell people what we watched. So okay. We both watched Ship of Fools because it won for black and white.
Right. King Rat, you watched. Patch of Blue, I watched. The Slender Thread, you watched. The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, I watched. And then for color, we both watched Dr. Zhivago because it won. Agony and the Ecstasy, I watched. Greatest Story Ever Told, I watched. Inside Daisy Clover, you watched. And Sound of Music, you watched.
And I would say, I mean, I didn't watch your movies, obviously, but from what I watched, I agreed with the Oscar winner. Like, I was trying to, like, think about, like, who would I vote for? And at the end of the day, Dr. Zhivago is just so much stuff on stuff on stuff. And, like, every set is used two ways or three ways. Sometimes it's, you know, abandoned and then it's cleaned up and then it's destroyed. It was just like every, I kept thinking about the set dressing team in that movie going, it never ended. And then, you know, the art director trying to figure out like where these things go and, or maybe it was the AD, I don't know, but I was really inspired by how much stuff. And then, you know, learning that they shot it in Spain because they couldn't go to Russia because it was banned was like so interesting to me because I don't know Russia other than what is in the press essentially and my own imagination. And so I believed every second of that movie that it was telling me it was Russia.
But the snow parts they did over in like Poland or something, didn't they?
They used a couple of places, yeah, but they were supposed, so I allegedly, from what I read on Wikipedia, they went to Spain because they were quote unquote guaranteed snow. And then it was the warmest winter in 50 years in Spain. So they had to go to Finland, I think. And then they went to a couple other places, I don't remember, but the Ice Palace, of course, which is such an incredible set. Amazing. In general, just so inspiring and so beautiful. And the hallway is just so unbelievably long. Like when he's down the hallway, it's like, this is like a football field. But that's when I, as a designer, got really inspired. Like, you can do these things to tell a story. And sometimes it's really hard to convince producers or directors of photography. Like, I had a situation on Glamorous, or sorry, on the Matlock pilot, where I kept telling people, like, we don't need walls around the office. And they're like, yeah, but they need privacy. It's a law firm. I'm like, but we know that. The audience doesn't know that.
Right.
That was a really hard sell because everyone was looking at the room through the lens of being in the room. And I'm like, the audience doesn't see half of this room. So don't even put the wall there, kind of stuff. And I think that you need a really charismatic, strong art department in general to convince people like, trust us. This is good storytelling. At least that's what I got out of the Ice Palace because it was ridiculous. There's no way you could believe that could be true.
Let's start with the color winner, Dr. Zhivago.
Okay.
If no one knows, it's the life of a Russian physician and who's actually a poet. And although he's married to one woman, he falls in love with another. And it's set during World War I in the October Revolution in Russia. Now, I had read this book, watched this movie when I was in college, and I hated it. I hate this story. I'm not talking about the design. I'm talking about the story. And then watching it again, he's a jerk. He's a dick. He's got a pregnant wife, and he leaves her for a chick that he was... I don't get it.
I do find it interesting that the point of view of the movie shows it like he's, like, we feel
so
for
torn.
Him.
Yeah, so torn.
Yeah, like, and it's like,
wait a minute. I'm a poet. No.
His wife's actually really great.
Yeah.
Like, she's super supportive.
She's saving coal for when he comes home and her and the kid are freezing during the day. She's cleaned up
that abandoned house. Yeah. She has time to put flowers in vases.
Why they don't go into the big house is beyond me.
They'll get arrested. They say something. There's a really funny line. They're like, we can't go in there. It's bad. But they didn't lock that place.
They won't see our lights on over here. Like, it made no sense. But then they could when it was him and his hot girl. No. Yeah, Julie Christie gets the big house. That's the moral of the story.
But that's true, too.
It's a sad story, I would say. In Russian literature, always sort of like sadness. But it starts with music, which most films don't do now, and that overture, and you know you're in for something big, and right away it tugs at your heartstrings with this little boy whose mom dies, and it's so sad, and maybe that's why you love him, or you feel for him, because you know he had tragedy as a young boy, I don't know.
Well, and he keeps getting, like, basically kidnapped to work as a doctor for different arms. That I do feel for him for that. And then he got paired up with, you know, his lover, and she was a nurse. Like, the story itself is, I would say it's good and it's lyrical, it's like a poem, but the making of it does make that movie be what it is. I mean, the restaurant and the use
the
of
restaurant.
Red,
the red restaurant is fantastic.
Yeah, and there's just so many parts to it that are, you know, knowing that they built that Moscow street from scratch. And all the props that are just like, it's overwhelming. And that's what seduced me into loving the movie, is that it just was so much stuff. And it was a world that I'm not familiar with.
Right.
You know, I really
either.
Not.
Yeah.
I don't understand it well enough. And it's, you know, I don't know if it's being a product of the 80s, but during the Cold War, you know, Russia was just, we only knew about it at certain lens, and to be able to see this movie that showed it so romantic, even though it was sad and depressing, I thought was really remarkable.
Yeah.
And the cinematography is outstanding.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
And like all the close-ups, and it is really beautiful.
The costumes are great. His apartment is great. Like, the textures in his apartment that they pick up, I thought that was fantastic.
I think my favorite set is actually, I'm not sure whose it is, but it's Laura's at work. Like, it's the seamstress place.
Oh, yes. The little seamstress. Shop.
Long hallway. Yeah. And you see where they're working. And then you go in the back room. That set was just spectacular. And the set dressing, of course, is just.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Note that they had to make that in Spain. And
it's a different level. It's a different level. And I'm sure it would. That could compare to something made today, I believe. I think his coloring was really, I mean, he's supposed to be a handsome man. He was like gray in every single shot. Like, I don't know if it was, I don't know. I felt like.
Well, I think the whole movie is like, except for the color red, honestly, the whole movie is kind of dingy.
Yeah.
The rail car, oh my gosh, it does. It just goes on and on and on. There's just, I didn't keep a ton of notes on it because all I wrote was stuff on stuff on stuff. That's our scene three different ways. The Ice Palace is in spring, it's in winter, and then the college is dirty and abandoned and then pretty. Like, every set has multiple uses.
The production designer was John Box and Terrence Marsh, and decorator was Dario Simeone. Now, there's the thing, too, is as we go through this, there's a lot of people who did, like, two movies that year.
That's unbelievable. That rosters. Dario... is credited for both that and the Agony and the Ecstasy, which go ahead and talk about. I didn't see that.
Agony Ecstasy is the story of Michelangelo while he was painting the Sistine Chapel. It stars Charlton Heston as Michelangelo and Rex Harrison as the Pope. The funniest thing is I put the movie on, my husband's watching with me, and he's like, you know, these two didn't get along while they made this. And Rex Harrison wore lifts to make him look taller. And I was like, how do you know this? Like, he knew trivia already, so that was good. It was nominated for 5 Oscars and didn't win any. It was shot in Rome and Tuscany. The Sistine Chapel, which was a set, is amazing to me. that they did all this and then build all the scaffold. Like, it's a huge, it's to scale, it looks like, Sistine Chapel. And then they still built all the scaffolding and everything around it because they have many scenes of him up there painting. Amazing to me is they have this aerial shot of the Vatican. And I don't know how they got that because you can't, it's not like a helicopter or something. Like, I don't know how they got it, which is intriguing to me. And I tried to look it up, but I couldn't find anything. It's definitely a little history lesson of Michelangelo's work. It's taken from a book, and this is only one chapter of the book. I just started the book because I was like, well, I'll gratefully like learn about Michelangelo. So I'm not up to this chapter yet, but this is a chapter in one of the books. There's a lot of gorgeous tapestry. There's a lot of, you know, amazing paintings. They show the process of doing the paintings, of put like dot, which I know that we still do sometimes. You take the paper and you put dots on it, and then you put the paper on the wall, and then, you know, that
it's called a pounce.
Pounce, yeah. You pounce them, and then you have that stencil up on the wall, and that's how they did most of it. Him making colors, his whole struggle. The costumes of the Pope are good. His whole struggle is like, he didn't want to do it because he was a sculptor. So then they have a show some of his sculpturing, which not too much, but just in the beginning. Besides the set of the Sistine Chapel, which is great, there's not much other depth going on with other sets. It's like the Pope's room, which I believe had this giant map, a lot of maps, and then a lot of tapestries on the walls. And then I can't think of anything else. I mean, it was a lot of performance. And then the Sistine Chapel is the real like gem of the sets, which was amazing that they did it. So yeah. Oh, with the one other thing is there's a big model. That's what it is. The Pope has this huge model in the middle of his room, which was really cool. And then wallpaper, which I don't understand why they had wallpaper, but.
So that was done by the set decorator Dario Simone as well. So that Dario had a really busy year.
Yeah. I mean, especially this was in Rome and Tuscany, and he's back and forth to Spain. He was in demand.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, actually. Yeah. I would say that I'll jump to The Sound of Music because anybody who hasn't seen that movie probably isn't listening to this podcast.
True.
So it was a good reason to watch it again, and knowing that it was up against Dr. Zhivago, I actually it kind of got my sympathy vote for a while before I had watched, because Dr. Zhivago was the last movie that I watched out of all of these, and because I was dreading a three-hour movie. And then interestingly enough, Sound of Music is really long too.
All of mine were like 2.5-3 hours.
Sound of Music, from a production design standpoint, obviously relies heavily on the locations, because it is a story about locations, but you realize how much Austria is in the movie. Like, they went through a lot of effort, that obviously the director of photography, production designer, set dressing, furniture choices, patterns, you know, all of it. It's just gorgeous. I don't need to go on and on about The Sound of Music, because, you know, people love that movie. It's cherished. And it would be sad to me if anybody ever tried to remake it, because it is almost a near perfect movie. I find it interesting, too, that a lot of people don't watch the second act, because I was reading a little bit about the movie. Mm. And people make it through the first act, and then she gets married, and then they stop. It's like they don't know that there's this whole, like, running to Switzerland. And just how amazing even the tonal shift between the acts, and like going to the cemetery, and how scary that is, even for a scene that's a family movie. Like, it is scary, actually. It's very scary. And how it's all lit and everything. So Sound of Music, I can see why it got beat out by Zhivago just in scale. But as far as, to me, thematic storytelling, Sound of Music is like it's probably in the top three or top five of all time greatest production design.
Yeah, it is. It's also another level, which I think intrigued us for this year of like, look at the caliber of these movies up against each other.
And I didn't actually look, I should have, I'm assuming the mansion inside is a set. Obviously, the bedroom is a set.
I think that's a set.
They had to do so much, but like knowing that they, you know, they, you're right. It had to be with the like choreography of the kids going upstairs and all of that. Like, I'm sure it was, but you just buy into it. You really don't ever question it. And I mean, here I am, I've seen that movie probably 50 times and I never really broke that down because it's so wonderfully believable. Yeah.
You don't, but I ask people that all the time. They're like, did you build that? Like, because I'm lost in like the magic of filmmaking of like, that's a real place, right? Like, I know better.
Now that I'm thinking about it, the courtyard of the Abbey is probably fake too, maybe. I mean, yeah. She runs across it. So I'd have to look back at that more carefully. But that is one thing that I have really enjoyed about looking back at the older movies because they don't have CGI. How much more impressive it is to see when you know that they built this. It's like, man, they didn't, I mean, matte painting, of course, but like, it is a whole different level, you're right.
But now you did the live version of Rent and won an Emmy for it. They did a live version of Sound of Music.
Yes, they did. And that was the first one. That was the one that kind of paved that era.
Yeah.
You know, interestingly enough, Sound of Music was first and Rent was not last, but third to last or something. I think they tried Annie and then they tried...
Little Mermaid.
Yeah, but those are a little bit different because they're not, they're more sing-alongs because they're not actually doing the whole show, in my opinion. I mean, that's brass tacks, but like, Encanto is like not a reenactment of the movie. It's just people coming out to sing this. Then that's what they did with Little Mermaid and that's what they did with Beauty and the Beast, which to me is a production cop-out, to be honest. It's like, well, we don't want to spend all the money, so let's half it.
Right. I mean,
sorry, Disney, that's my critique on it. And it comes across that way. You know, it's not like a full thing. It's just kind of like, here's this amazing IP that we could remake. We've already made it live. We could do it, you know, meaning live action. We could do it in a way that could be special live. And they don't, to me, they don't go all the way. So.
Yes, I will agree with you on that. It took a turn. It took a turn to cater probably to audience and advertising.
So Boris Levin and Walter M. Scott and Ruby Levitt, like, just, you know, hats off.
And Sound of Music won Best Picture that year.
It earned it. It certainly did. I would say it and It's a Wonderful Life, you know, kind of take turns being some of my favorite, like, all-time movies.
I don't like A Wonderful Life.
Okay, all right, I told you my pitch to my juror.
Yes. Damn it, I saw him last week. I should have told him.
So then I'll jump to Inside Daisy Clover. Yeah. So this is a movie I knew nothing about. Quickly, it's a really interesting story about, let me just get to the plot of what it is, because they can read faster than...
It's Natalie Wood, right?
And Natalie Wood. So Daisy Clover is a 15-year-old tomboy who dreams of being a Hollywood star. After auditioning for producer Raymond Swan at Swan Studios, she becomes the toast of Hollywood. Daisy must come to terms with her newfound fame and the 1930s Hollywood star treatment. So the thing that was great about the movie is that, you know, you're seeing the 30s. You're seeing 1965 make the 30s, which is what Sound of Music was doing, interestingly enough. So that was obviously a hot timeline to be doing. There is a lot of great scenery in it. It's filmed Santa Monica Pier before it's the pier that we know of. Oh. So it was fun to see that in the lens of 1965. It's actually kind of a dark story. The studio, Richard Plummer, who played the captain in Sound of Music, is also the studio executive in Inside Daisy Clover. And they basically take this young starlet, Daisy Clover, and they force her to put her wife into a psychiatric home, and they kind of take over her life, and they, you know, essentially pull the corset tight on her. And you see how Hollywood was manipulating these performers. Very interesting commentary, and it does not make a studio look good at all. I mean, studio executives generally don't look good in movies. They certainly are not looking great now in the press, if you think about it.
No.
But it is interesting how they were portrayed in this movie. But the thing that was a highlight is that there are a few sets from the, like, of 1938 movies, and they are totally through the lens of 1965. So they're not period accurate at all, in my opinion.
Oh, that's funny.
Which I found interesting. The haircuts aren't really period either. Like, sometimes movies are period adjacent. And
yeah, they take liberties.
Yeah, this one was being period adjacent. But the most outstanding set was, I guess you call him Mr. Swan, the executive producer of the studio's office was just, you know, like so glamorous 1938. The production designer just completely went to town with, you know, all white, very deco, beautiful scenery. And then you're at Warner Brothers and you see Warner Brothers backlot and stuff. Is it a movie that I recommend people watching? Not really. Scenically, was it interesting? Yes. Did it compare to Sound of Music or Chicago? No, it was a different level. And I don't mean that bad. Robert Clatworthy and George James Hopkins. George was the set decorator. Robert was the production designer or art director. It's good, but it's not in that same level. It has music in it. So maybe that's why it was maybe on par with Sound of Music. I don't know.
You know, I also tried to look at other things that were nominated that year. And because I have the same feeling about, A Patch of Blue. What else was there that could have been nominated? But I don't know enough of these other movies to keep watching either. So
it just makes me wonder if they in a year where there was black and white and color, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah, we have 10 each.
Five of each.
Yeah.
So I wonder if they just decided that. So you had 10 movies, you know, nominated for design. But what an incredible thing.
It goes back and forth because I'm also doing 1950 and there was only 3 in each category. So I don't know how they varied or made rules up or whatever. Maybe it was based on percentage of how many were done that year. I don't know. I can't figure it out because it's different every year. But I believe 1966 is the last time they did it. Black and white and color. I think that was the last one. And it's also weird that, like, we're doing the movies of 1965, but it's actually the Oscars of 1966. Because it comes out the next year. Just so if anyone's following along at home, you gotta look up on Oscars.org 1966. That's the year we're doing.
You have the Agony and the Ecstasy.
I did Agony and Ecstasy. Now the greatest story ever told. I told Adam I'd take the religious ones.
She did.
A greatest story ever told is a huge epic movie that chronicles the life and ministry of Jesus Christ. So tons of stars, directed by George Stevens. It's if you need a religious lesson, it's great. It's got everything in there. It's great. There's a lot of painted backgrounds, like, you know, the rock cave or like whatever their dwelling is. And then there's a lot of painted, you could tell that they were painted backgrounds, which I thought, oh, that's an artwork. Like that's a reference if anybody ever needs it. It was nominated for 5 Oscars, didn't win any. Production designer David Hall died before the movie was released because they filmed it in 62, 63, and he died in 64. He also is the production designer of Double Indemnity, and he was also an assistant director on My Fair Lady. So this guy did a lot. 47 sets were constructed on location and in studios, and it was the most expensive movie of the year at $20 million. So it cost more than Dr. Zhivago, which kind of blew my mind too, but maybe because they did that overseas, it was less or something. I don't know.
Zhivago has so much going on. You're right. That is a hard thing to believe. I would have thought Dr. Zhivago would have blown a budget.
Dr. Zhivago's budget was $11
million. Hmm. That's crazy. They did rely on nature for a big portion of it, you know, in the war scenes. And
The production designer, the set decorator, Richard Day, right? Richard Day.
Ray Moyer, Fred McLean, and Norman Rocket.
Oh, Richard Day is also the production designer. 281 films.
Wow. Oh, he must have been the head of a studio department or something.
On the Waterfront, Streetcar Named Desire, Joan of Arc, Miracle on 34th Street. Back in the day when designers were, you know, involved in all of these, like, art departments, and they were just the head designer or head art director. There were so many films going through them. It's crazy. And when you start to look back, like, that's why multiple people are nominated, because it was under the same studio. So I don't really have, like, I mean, the death scene is amazing, and the lighting and everything. I don't know. It's amazing. Like, all the sets, the chronicalization, the scenery is great. I forget, it is in, like, California and Arizona. Yeah.
Did you say Ray Stevens?
Gray Stevens, yeah.
Ray, the director of it?
Yes. No, George Stevens.
George Stevens. He's actually responsible for the Kennedy Center Honors. He's got a connection to, like, being the director for that for a long time. I'm almost positive him and his son kind of ran that, which just find interesting that they gave us that. Like, that, yeah. You know, people are like, oh, that's been around forever. Well, it actually wasn't. It was a fundraiser for the Kennedy Center. And it took, you know, George Stevens bringing it to what it was. And now it's, you know, he passed away, but I think his son took it over, and they don't do it anymore.
It was mostly in Utah, Arizona, California, and then I don't think they went anywhere overseas to do it, which I was like, oh, okay. I mean, that's a good resource of America, I guess. But
well, no, it makes sense. There's a lot of desert. You can film that in Southern California.
Yeah. It was good. What I never knew, or I guess never realized, was that Max von Sydow plays Jesus. I never realized that it was him playing that. And then he's the exorcist, which is amazing.
That is actually quite a he was not typecast.
Yeah. So it's a beautiful movie. It's a great story. It's a history lesson. Again, Charlton Heston's in it. He plays John the Baptist. It's all there if anybody wants it. It's very well done, I would say. Not one of my favorites.
So that's shifting to black and white.
Yes.
I loved watching all the black and white movies that I saw. I loved. I don't have a complaint about any of them.
We both watched Ship of Fools, which was the winner. You watch King Rat, I watch Patch of Blue, you watch The Slender Thread, and I watch The Spy Who Came In from the Cold. So
start with that one. I want to hear. I was most intrigued with that one. What is that about?
So The Spy Who Came In from the Cold is Richard Burton. And this is based on a book series by John le Carré. And he wrote a bunch of books about this, and this is one of them. But it's kind of like Richard Burton is like a MI6 before it was MI6. So he's kind of a spy, and he thinks he's at his last job, but then he gets pulled in to do one more. And so it's kind of like his last mission, and he gets a little too attached to a girl, and he kind of like, there's a lot of double crossing and.
Spy movie or an action movie or both? Or?
It's spy. I don't think it's too much action. Like, maybe there's one car scene.
I find it interesting because that's like a genre that's obviously very popular but doesn't get nominated very much. It's rare that like spy action makes its way into the Oscar nominee category of any kind, I think. Yeah. I mean, James Bond movies are amazing, but they hardly ever make it into the nominee world.
The sets, I mean, as his cover, he works in a little library. The girl who he's interested in has a cute little, like, nondescript apartment. They're shooting in London, like, for 1965. So that was cool to watch. That was like, oh, look, I don't know London. Like, look at these streets and the cars. And, like, for me, that was interesting. The most interesting set I believe they had was he goes to, like, a safe house. And it's, like, you know, wallpaper peeling and like an old furnace, and they got him on a ratty bed, and like, you know, they spent time doing that one to make it like look like a shit house. There's also like a makeshift courtroom, which is pretty and nice, but it's like all of a sudden he's like in a courtroom. It's weird. But the movie was good. I would have never watched it, so I'm glad that I got to see it. I like Richard Burton. I thought he was really good in it. And there's some double crossing, and yeah, I liked it. My husband liked it. It was good.
Well, the Slender Thread, which has got Sidney Poitier and Anne Bancroft, there's other people in it, but those two were the most obviously stand out. And you didn't know this, but I was already on a Sidney Poitier run. I had watched Guest Is Coming to Dinner, Lilies of the Field, and To Sir With Love all in the last couple of weeks.
Oh.
And, you know, he is such a fine, fine actor. He just, his expressions, the way he carries himself. So I was watching, you know, Sydney. The Story of a Thin Thread is a great, it's an interesting story. I do not believe this movie would fly these days. I just don't think that people would want to make it, or at least show it. So essentially, the person Anne Bancroft is playing is a mother of one, and it's disclosed early in the movie that, oh, I don't want to give it away, actually, because people should watch it. But ultimately, she takes her own life by having too many barbiturates, and they show it, which really shocked me for the time. I was like, they really show her doing that. And then Sidney Poitier is a senior or a freshman in college in psychology, and he's doing the overnight phone at a call center in Seattle. It all takes place in 1965 Seattle, which is great to see because, you know, Seattle is so modern. In 1965, oh my God, it was like, I can only imagine what it would have been like to been in that city at that time. And that movie enjoys that. And the other thing, before I get back to the plot, this particular movie isn't so concerned about being accurate. They're showing great living rooms and beautiful bedrooms and gorgeous fashion. It's really enjoying itself, like it wants to take you on this journey. So she calls the crisis center. Sidney Poitier answers the phone, and his job is to keep her on the phone despite challenges emotionally, of course, because he's never done anything like this, so that they can trace her call. And so the A story is obviously like Sidney and Poitier's relationship with this person who's trying to take their own life. But then you go to an ATT call center, and you go to the fire station, you go to the police department, you get to see all these systems that were in place to try and trace a phone call. And that part blew my mind. We don't have anything like that nowadays. I mean, the close-up would be of a server rack now.
Right. Technology.
You know, there's obstacles. They have to send a guy to the airport, and then they have to go to a hotel, and it's the cattleman's reunion, and there's a big party. The sets, for what they are obviously very well done, but it's a totally different scale, and it's modern times for that period. So I have no complaint about them, but you can't really compare them to some of the more period things, which is, it's difficult. I mean, that's why the Emmys separates contemporary from fantasy or period, because it's not apples to apples. You know, you're comparing two different styles of design. But anyway, I highly recommend watching the movie. It's a very good movie. I do wonder if you were to remake this movie now, if you were to cast a non-white woman in the leading role, how people would perceive the movie, because there's some really great social commentary going on in it.
I was going to say, they did that Jake Gyllenhaal movie where he's on the line the whole time. Did you see that?
Oh, I don't know. That one, an ambulance one?
No, he's a call center guy. It was okay. It was all right.
I love Jake Gyllenhaal, so I'm surprised I haven't seen
him. Hit that one. Get on a Jake Gyllenhaal spread.
Well, I'm kind of enjoying the old movies for a while. I'm going to live in this for a while.
For the first movie I watched was A Patch of Blue. And I was like, oh, this is depressing. I don't want to get it.
I'm assuming it's patriotic. Is it patriotic?
No. It is Sidney Poitier and Shirley Winters. And Shirley Winters is a huge bitch. And she lives in a one-room apartment with her teenage daughter, who is blind, who you find out during the movie she made blind accidentally when she was like 5 or 6. And then they live with, and then her grandpa lives on the other side of the room, and they're like trash and they're mean to her and they never let her out of the apartment. And some days one of the neighbors takes her to the park, MacArthur Park in downtown LA, which no one should take anyone to these days.
Oh, right. Yeah. Even now. Yeah.
Yeah. And, he has a little job for her. She puts together, pearl necklaces. Well, one day, Sidney Poitier is walking along and she drops something or whatever, and they become friends. And he works at a newspaper, I believe. He's like educated, well, you know, well dressed, everything. And his brother's a doctor, and he's big on society. But of course, she doesn't know he's black. It's all about, you know, she's falling in love with someone and she doesn't know who he is. And then the mom finds out, and racial things ensue, and it's not like horrible, but it is a really good movie. I don't understand how it's nominated for production design. I'm sorry. because like I said before, it's like their shitty apartment, which I understand. But at one point she's like, I'm going to go take a bath. And they show the apartment. There's no bathroom. I don't know where she was. She went into the kitchen. I don't know what happened there. And then his apartment is very stark, 1960s, mid-century. But there's nothing that stands out to me in this movie, like, at all. Their budget was $800,000. I mean, it wasn't big in that way. Let's see what else.
You almost got to wonder, like you said, what was it up against that allowed it to get in, you know?
I did love the wallpaper in their tenant apartment. It is packed with dressing. It is a good set. I just don't understand how it's Oscar worthy. Mm. That's it.
I wanted to mention one more thing about a Thin Thread. The director of it, who was, I got to look his name up real quick, and I just forgot it. Sidney Pollack.
Oh, Sidney Pollack, I love.
Yeah, exactly. Tootsie. It was his first film. So, like, if you're a director, you know, you're interested in following director's career, it's a great, great, great gateway, because this movie has a very interesting use of suspense. And then you look at this person, the director's career, and you see 3 Days of the Condor, which you've never seen, is an excellent movie. And then that, you know, then you see Tootsie and The Firm and Out of Africa and Sabrina and Random Hearts. Like, there's an incredible body of work that this director gave us. And that was this person's first movie.
Oh, that's a good
interesting
one.
That you're talking about Patch of Blue also having Sidney Poitier, that I'm learning from you, having watched Patch of Blue, that he was so influential in making race divisions accessible. Like, he obviously was a safe choice. I don't know any other way to say that.
Yeah.
To make movies that allowed white people to see people of color differently, maybe. And I didn't really recognize that, to know that he, like, what a career, you know. Oh, unbelievable.
He's unbelievable. I mean, I can't think of anyone else like him who went for it in every single role to be the first, or to show that you can, or to be it, and like, be great. Yeah, I mean, he graded it. It's not like he sucked and did it. Like, he's a great actor.
Well, and also, like, he was being a great actor, not just providing social commentary. Like, Lilies of the Field and To Sir With Love also have a racial component to them. It's small, not To Sir With Love. It's bigger in that one, and it's actually addressed. But, like, that's so obvious. He's just busy being a great actor. You know, yeah. Like, Sidney Poitier was like, you're going to love him in anything you want. So.
I did, this little note, I did read that Shelley Winters hated playing this part because she was a huge supporter of the civil rights movement, and she was overwhelmed and speechless the night she won Oscar for Best Actress in a Supporting Role. She didn't like the role at all.
So do you agree with the winners? Oh, we have to talk about Ship of Fools.
Yeah, talk about Ship of Fools, which was the winner for Black and White. I didn't have this up.
Can I go first?
Yes.
Because I actually like the movie. It sounded like
too. You
that enchanted by it. I actually think out of all the movies that I watched, it's the one that surprised me the most. So for people who don't know, it does have a plot, but for me it was almost plotless. We know that this ship is leaving from Mexico, going to Germany, and it's got 2 stops, I think, on the way. And the boat is full of people who don't know World War II is about to happen, and they're carrying on their lives, which we all know is dramatically going to change very mm-hmm. shortly after this boat gets into the harbor. That's how I felt about the movie. And there's incredible one-liners and very good encapsulations of lessons that we still haven't learned as a society in it. It makes me want to read the novel, because I read that they changed a few things and added things to make it more like movie centric. But from a set design standpoint, the wides I thought were used really well. I thought the first 20 minutes were spectacular. They projected the ocean, and I still don't know if we could do that as successful today. Mm-hmm. We just green screen it, and it was so beautifully well done. It felt realistic and proportioned right. You know, if we were to remake that movie now, we'd make it grandiose and big, and it would be like even more, you know, beyond the best Disney cruise ship. We just would.
Yeah.
But I like, there's this where there's flamenco dancers and they're at the bar and the proportions are tiny. Like, you can actually believe this boat is cramped and small, and they shoot in a cabin and it's cramped. I don't think DPs nowadays would let you do that. Like, no. Am I wrong? Like, I feel like everybody's like, I need more room. I need to get in fast. It's like, yeah, but then it doesn't look real. That's at least the notes that I get.
They built the whole thing. That's incredible to me.
It is incredible. And then the other thing about it is that I think it would have been really interesting in color. I found it, I mean, I liked that it was in black and white, but I think if we saw that in color, we would just love it because the color palette probably was spectacular. And then the wides when they go to their ports mm-hmm. were so big. I mean, think about when they pull into,
yeah,
they have to get a bunch of people from Cuba, I think.
That's what I was saying too. That, there's so many extras. There's so like so this many port, extras. Like they're out like on a dock, like it's huge.
Yeah, they pull into the Canary Islands at one point to leave, you know, to let someone off. And it's, I mean, you know, it's matte painted because they didn't go to the Canary Islands, but it's just beautiful. I really, really enjoyed this movie and I would never have watched it had it yeah. been for the assignment. So thank you for that, because I'm going to think about this movie for a while.
I would never have watched it either. I love that it's Vivien Leigh. She's fantastic. I believe it was her last movie.
Yeah, I was. Brian that as well.
She's
a wonderful scene where she dances. That yes. scene really stuck out for me.
Because there was some detail I was reading is if the music is really in her mind when she starts dancing, because all of a sudden the music comes out of nowhere to show that she's a little crazy. The music just starts and she starts dancing. Or like, I guess there was discussion if like she heard music, but then it stops. So to me, it's in her head, but I don't know. So I read they built the whole ship. They had tons of extras. I thought the same thing, that the details of the ship were fantastic. I thought it was a shame that it was in black and white, just like you. It's the only Best Picture nominee to be nominated for art direction in black and white and cinematography black and white. Initially, the director, Stanley Kramer, considered filming aboard an actual ship, but that was determined to be too difficult. A ship set was built at Columbia Studios, and the second unit filmed backgrounds at sea. A ship set extended over 4 sound stages and had 4 levels. Special effects were done at Paramount Studios, so the whole set had to be broken down into 44 sections, each measuring 16 by 12, and then trucked over to Paramount, according to an article from the LA Times.
Wow. I mean, that's so inspiring to me.
That's insane. And
you can tell when you watch that movie that there was great care. And the other thing that I liked about it, from a technically speaking, like, to me, it almost puts Titanic to shame.
Yes.
Because the way they shoot, you do not know that you're on a set. Like, they're very, I mean, you do because we know what they are doing. But, like, they, at the time, I'm going to guess, you wouldn't have known, you know. I'm sorry if you can hear the lawnmower. I can't do anything about
it. No, I can't hear it. I do think there was one scene. I think it's Vivien Leigh and the other chick, and they're like on the outer deck, and the level of the ocean is a little cockeyed.
Oh, yeah, I did. I know exactly what you're talking about. I felt that same way.
Actually. I was like, uh-oh.
So they ran out of footage. They're like, yeah, I used the one we already used.
Yeah.
The fact that they had to have carefully planned, that's what I admired about the movie so much, is that they had a director and a DP who must have sat down and said, we're going to do this scene like this,
yeah.
and then we're going to transition, because there's a lot of following one person talk for a long time, and then the camera just starts following someone else. So they planned out 20-minute sequences, 15-minute sequences, not just scene. And the end, my gosh, the end is a parade. I don't even think
there's any dialogue. In the train station, right?
Yeah, you can see the backdrop in that one. You know that it's on a soundstage, but man, is it a big set.
That's a huge and just, build.
Like you said, layer and layer and layer.
Production design by Robert Clatworthy and set decoration by Joseph Kish. I think they nailed it for black and white. I mean, you didn't talk about King Rat.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I didn't.
We got so excited about the fools.
I did, because I loved it so much. I'll talk about King Rat in a second. But so if you had to say color or black and white, be gone. Like, they're just one pile of movies.
Yeah. I think it's Zhivago.
I would actually, yeah, I'd have to rewatch it. But I was very, very seduced by Ship of Fools and was very excited by that. So I guess you're right. Zhivago's still going to win because it was so big.
I think it's close, though.
So King Rat Another movie I would not have watched. It takes place in a Singaporean war camp post-World War II. Let me just get the official tagline because I know what my experience watching it was, but I should, you know, portray the movie. So when Singapore surrenders to the Japanese in 1942, the Allied prison of war, mostly British, but including a few Americans, are incarcerated in Changi prison. This was a prison of war camp like no other. It goes on and on and on. But basically what you need to know is that the American, the cast, you're going to want to know who the cast was. George Segal, Tom Courtney, James Fox, Patrick O'Neill, and there's a lot of other men in the movie. I don't think there's any women in the entire movie. You know, it's following like the life of living in a prison war camp. The production design is very good. You're in a lot of like prisoner of war huts and you see the prison. It's very gross. You see cockroaches, but the king rat comes from George Segal is basically, I would call him a mob boss. And he, you know, is earning money and he's trading and he's doing a lot of things that he should not be doing. And then he convinces a group of American soldiers with the help of one British soldier to basically farm raise rat meat and sell it, you know, on the market to other Americans.
Is this a true story?
It is based on a novel. I don't know how true it is, but I don't actually know if it's a true story. It is based on a novel. I know that because I did find that in 1965, almost everything we watched was based on a novel. But the production design is really good. I mean, it's a war movie. I would say it fits into that category, even though it's not, there's no fighting. There's a fist fight, I think, in it, and there is people who die, but it's not a movie that I would highly recommend unless you're really into war movie. But from doing like thatched roof and avoiding some of the more cliche things you see when people do Vietnam, it was well done. I will say that I was really intrigued with how they laid it all out, and not knowing anything about what prisoner of war camps looked like in Singapore, I believed it. It was all shot in California. You believe that because you don't really see much outside the camp. It almost looks like a desert. I always thought Singapore was tropical, but you're kind of in between tropical. Yeah. And you go out and you see palm trees, but where they're actually living is like barren, almost wasteland. And maybe that's what prisons were like. I don't know.
I probably won't watch that.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, it's cerebral and you think a lot, you know, and obviously there's a lot of hardship. I'm sure it brings back some post-traumatic stress from people who lived through it. And, you know, as far as like cataloging the American experience of the war, it's probably very good. But it did make me think of how amazing 1911, what was the one that was out a couple of years ago, the war movie that was all filmed in one take, or a big portion of it was one take?
The one that won Best Picture this year?
No.
No, 1912?
Yeah, 1912.
Yeah.
Let's look up what it is. That movie, you know, you kind of, you feel the dirt, you feel it, 1917. And, you know, obviously there's this whole genre, and then we just had the war movie that came out last year, that the production design for that was unbelievably good. So if you're interested in that genre, then I would say, sure, watch this movie. But
I did forget to say, in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, they do show like the wall, like checkpoints. Like the Berlin Wall, East Berlin, West Berlin.
Oh, I see.
There's a lot of that too, which is interesting to see. Like, God, isn't that crazy? Like, yeah. And especially the ending of the movie happens at a wall. It's a really, yeah, I forgot to point that out. But I'm not really into war movies, so it kind of pushes me into watch what you have to design and decorate to make it happen. And it is still.
Like, yeah, I mean, did I believe it? Yes. Did it tell the story? It framed the story. I don't know if I could say it told the story. I mean, it did what it needed to.
Yeah.
The production designer was Robert Emmett Smith, and the set decorator was Frank Tuttle, which I think Frank Tuttle pops up a lot. I think that that person got a lot of work, but not necessarily 1965, because I feel like I've seen that name on credits before.
I did look up other movies that came out that year, whether I had seen them or not. There wasn't anything that super stuck out of like, whoa, why wasn't that nominated? Or so I believe all of these movies for these years tell something. There's a reason why Patch of Blue was nominated. I don't know, but I think that they are probably the best of the best for that year, especially the color ones. Well, I don't know. Yeah. You said Daisy Clover. I don't know. So
I mean, Daisy Clover was, you can see why it was nominated. Mm-hmm. You can. I also can see why it didn't win when you compare it to, you know, the other movies. Yeah. It's interesting, but I think, you know, what's hard to me, and I struggle with this as a voter for anything that I vote on. Let's say that the movie itself isn't very good. There was that Tom Cruise movie that was set in like space, that was like Air something or Atlas Cloud. The production design for that movie was incredible, but the movie itself was not that good. So it's hard to separate out sometimes. And Daisy Clover's production design is very beautiful and interesting, but the movie itself is kind of weighting it down. It's very tonally all over the place. So unfortunately, that's what happens. I mean, we worked on projects that we've been proud of separately, and then the audience never gets to see them because they're a pilot that never goes forward, or they don't like it. You know, like that's the thing, is that like that's just part of the hand that you get dealt as somebody who works in entertainment.
Maybe there was, I mean, maybe the whole patch of blue was built. I don't know. I mean, there had to be something. It doesn't even sound as grand as Inside Daisy Clover. Do you know what I mean? There's nothing to me that stuck out in that film.
Well, and you know, the ones that you described to me in the color category, Dr. Zhivago, The Agony and the Ecstasy, The Greatest Story Ever Told, Inside Daisy Clover, and The Sound of Music. It sounds like The Agony and the Ecstasy and Inside Daisy Clover were a whole different category compared to Dr. Zhivago, The Sound of Music, and The Greatest Story Ever Told. I mean, those are, they sounded enormous. I mean, it's like comparing a Marvel movie to a A24 movie. Mm-hmm. Like, they're two different things altogether.
Which we always have to do, like you said, like for whether it's the Emmys or the Oscars, like fantasy, and you always think like, oh, Game of Thrones, House of Dragons, you know, how can I compete with that? You know, there's just, you know,
that's... Uh-oh, we're pushing close to an hour. We got to cut it off.
I know. All right, so 1965, it was a great year of looking at, especially black and white versus color, I thought that was really interesting. I'm glad that we did that.
Me too.
Okay.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.